Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today, our special guest is Rick Sharga. Rick is the vice president of Carrington Mortgage Holdings. Rick is one of the country's most frequently quoted sources on foreclosure, mortgage, and real estate trends. Rick has appeared on every major network and news show in the country. He has even briefed government organizations such as the Federal Reserve and Senate Banking Committee on foreclosure trends. Prior to being with Carrington, Rick was senior vice president of Realty Tract, responsible for marketing and business development. Rick, welcome to our show.
Always good talking to you, Bruce.
Yeah, I guess welcome back would probably be more appropriate. I'm just curious, what kind of experience was it speaking in front of the Federal Reserve and the Senate Banking Committee on what you do?
It was an eye opener, and particularly things like the Senate Banking Committee, when you realize how broad a range of subject matter these folks have to try and become instant experts on. And I was in talking about some of the more arcane aspects of foreclosures and how the processes worked, and you know, explaining there's 51 different jurisdictions across the country that all operate a little differently, and it really gave me an appreciation for the magnitude of the job they try and do, simply because there's just so very much that they need to try and absorb. The Fed thing was kind of interesting too. It was a little humbling. I was talking to the chief microeconomist and the chief macroeconomist, and they were asking for my opinions on the market. This should be going the other way, shouldn't it? But you know, it was very gratifying, very humbling to have enough of a reputation within a certain subject matter to be able to share that information with people who could put it to use.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty fantastic. I do, and it is a daunting task for them. When you think about all the subjects that they have to try to get up to speed on, this is how they do it. They probably invite experts in and say, okay, get us up to speed.
and it also explains why sometimes, you know, well-intended and seemingly logical legislation gets passed that goes so horribly wrong, just because there really isn't the kind of expertise that comes with the business aspects of being involved in the day-to-day parts of the operations like a lot of us are.
Well, and the other part, too, then, is you really have agendas that step up to play, and so you have to cut through the, am I hearing facts or am I hearing wishful agendas?
You're suggesting that there's agendas to play in Washington? Bruce, I'm shocked. Shocked and appalled.
Well, just my humble opinion. So, Carrington Mortgage Holdings, where are you guys located, first of all? Is it based in California?
Our headquarters is in Orange County in Aliso Viejo. We have an investment group that's headquartered in Greenwich, Connecticut. And we have a pretty big servicing operation that has facilities in Santa Ana, California, and Fishers, Indiana.
And how many people altogether are employed by the company?
We're a little over 2,500 employees now.
Wow. And that's, from what I've been able to read, that's growing this year.
It is. We're seeing growth in a number of our businesses. The servicing business is growing. Our loan origination business is growing pretty rapidly. And we're also seeing some growth in our real estate brokerage. So it's been an interesting transition for me coming over to Carrington and you know, seeing all these various aspects of mortgage and real estate related businesses interact.
So is this the very definition of vertically integrated?
You know, we stopped talking about vertically integrated because nobody really understood it. But yeah, our CEO likes to say that we do just about everything involved in a residential real estate transaction outside of cutting down the trees.
Okay.
And it really is it's an integrated operation in that regard. We have business units that invest in pools of loans. We have business units that write loans and service loans. That buy and sell properties for consumers or investors, that write title insurance, that do property preservation and construction. So it really does run across the board. And you know, the flip side of that is, depending on who our customer is, they don't have to work with all those entities. They can work with just one of the businesses if that's you know, exactly what they're looking for.
It would sound like you guys have been in this business for 50 years, but that's really not the case.
No, it's sort of an accidental success story. That the company started really as an investment management business in 2003, investing in pools of subprime loans and managing the credit risk on those loans. When the market went sideways, the company bought the loan servicing business from New Century when New Century filed bankruptcy, and it did that primarily because the loans that had been purchased were sitting in that servicing platform, and so it was a defensive move. And Bruce Rose, our CEO, likes to say that he had visions of running a 12-person hedge fund in Connecticut and suddenly found himself with a 600-person servicing operation. And all the other businesses really have grown since then to support some of those core businesses.
It's funny how things work out sometimes.
It really is. I mean, I know that Bruce, or our Bruce, never had a master plan to be involved in all these various aspects of mortgage and real estate operations, but certainly has been flexible enough and had a vision once he got started to figure out how to put together what I think is a pretty unique business model.
I do too. You say you have a new origination business. Is that originating loans only for owner-occupants, or is that for investors as well?
It's primarily for owner-occupants. It's aimed at that market. We do an awful lot of FHA loans. We do refis as well, and we do both retail lending, so we have branches in about 22 states. And then we have a wholesale channel, so we're also working with mortgage brokers and helping them get their consumers funded.
Okay. One of the services you mentioned that you buy existing note pools. So let's talk a little bit about that. Now, is that a national pool usually?
You know, a lot of the pools are regional, Bruce, and we're buying nationally, but the pools very often have some regional influence to them. And really what we're buying mostly are pools of non-performing loans because our servicing group is very good at getting those loans to re-perform, which is a win-win. It's best for the borrower, and ultimately it's best for our investor as well.
So let's say, now, who's typically the seller? Is this an FHA, Fannie, or is it different than that?
Well, we've participated in both government agency pools, and we've also participated in pools sold off by large either lenders or other financial institutions. And typically, we work these loans through our servicing group. We ultimately wind up foreclosing on less than 20% of the loans that we purchase. So the guys are very good at finding a way to come up with alternative disposition strategies other than foreclosures.
And by the way, that's a big deal. It really is. When 8 out of 10 plus families get to stay there and retain ownership, is that typical, or they turn to lease? I mean, yeah, sometimes renters.
No, in fact, that's an interesting phenomenon too. We really expected to see more of an interest in people basically handing over the deed and taking a lease. But what we found is that the people that want to stay in the homes really want to stay in the homes as the borrower and just do a loan modification.
Okay.
Since we're buying these loans at a discount, we can usually pass on some of the savings in terms of lower payment prices on a mortgage. A lot of the people candidly don't want to stay anymore, and so they become very good candidates for short sales or even sometimes deeds in lieu.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in a lot of cases, people are just really ready to kind of move on and get on with the rest of their lives, and are happy for the opportunity to do a short sale so they don't have any you know, debt hanging over their head.
So would you say that a high percentage of time that the occupant owner is, well, what percentage is it? So they're cooperating with a short sale, or they're just getting the loan recast and they stay there and make the payment?
Those two categories pretty much make up the 80% that I talked to you about.
Okay.
I'd have a hard time. And it depends on the pool and what part of the country you're in. If you're in the Northeast and you're in a state like New York where you have 1,100-day foreclosure cycles, it's sometimes harder to get a borrower to agree to a short sale because they know they don't have to do anything for a couple of years.
1,100 days?
1,100 days for a foreclosure in New York, 1,000 in New Jersey. It's actually going to ultimately wind up having a negative effect on the real estate recovery in those states just because the distressed inventory is going to be around for so long.
Huh. Do you ever think we'll see a national foreclosure law?
Probably not, at least not in our lifetime.
Okay.
The CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, recently put out national loan servicing standards, and those were mostly aimed at servicing of delinquent loans. And after they issued their national standards, they issued an addendum that said basically, by the way, state laws trump these national laws.
Oh, no.
So, from the perspective of a company that does loan servicing in many states, and we do have a national footprint, it would be great to have one set of foreclosure rules and one set of servicing standards. But it really does get into the whole state's rights versus federal rights issue. And right now, foreclosure laws are all managed by the states.
Okay. Carrington also is buying properties?
We are, but very, very selectively. We think the market's a little frothy right now. I think you and I have talked about, how well some of these business models hold up or don't hold up as home prices appreciate very rapidly. And so right now we think there are better opportunities in things like non-performing loans and maybe mortgage servicing rights. We're just not willing to pay 125% of list price for a property that we're going to hold on to and try and get a rental return on.
And yet there seems to be a new player willing to do that almost every day.
Yeah, everybody has a different business model, and a lot of these there was an announcement recently by one of the companies about an IPO. And so if you're overpaying a little bit, but you put some leverage into your purchase by getting other people's money, sometimes the returns, look better. Now, I don't know what the implications are for the people that are doing the follow-on investing on properties that were, intrinsically overvalued. There's a lot of money coming into this. The return rates, it'll be interesting to see if they're able to deliver what their prospectus indicated they would.
You're probably a lot more familiar with the different business models that are out there. For Carrington's purpose, when you guys bought a property, was it always with the intent to have it occupied by a renter for some period of time and then resell it for a profit?
Yeah, typically when we buy a property, that is the model. It's almost always with the notion of having somebody rent the property out for a period of maybe 3 to 5 years and then sell it as home prices have appreciated. And our model was and is a hybrid model. There's rental returns built into it and there's home price appreciation built into it. When a market overheats, it really makes both parts of that model difficult to achieve. Just because the underlying collateral is potentially overpriced.
What was the surprise to you guys when, as you went through, let's say the buying effort, was there something that was more difficult than you thought it would be?
There are a couple things, and the two biggest really come down to inventory. The pipeline of REOs of lender owned properties really dried up much more quickly than we had anticipated, or I think that anybody had anticipated. And as part of that, there had been speculation that we'd see a lot of bulk sales, where you'd see fairly large pools of properties sold off, and that really simply hasn't been the case. There have been a couple exceptions over the last few years, but really, really not too much. And then the other, probably a little less surprise, but still a surprise, was how much interest developed in that particular asset class, how quickly. To your point, it seems like there's a new company announcing a $100 million fund just about every day. So it went from, gee, isn't that an interesting idea, to the investment topic du jour.
Yeah, when we're bidding at the trustee sale, we can always tell that somebody's gotten their first $100 million because it usually is spent in a three-day period.
Well, there. I heard, you know, along those lines, an anecdotal piece from an auction in Atlanta where one of these institutional guys ran out of checks, ran out of cashier's checks, so they actually had to go get another batch. And I thought that's pretty funny. But
you know what's sad about it is actually because they're doing so much business, the auctioneer actually waits for them to come back.
And I guess you probably can't blame them. It's not good for the local investor short term, but certainly from the auctioneer's perspective, it makes sense to wait for the person who's coming back with the fresh set of checks.
Yeah, to buy at the highest price.
I guess the encouraging thing that I've seen is because you worry about home price inflation rather than appreciation. And as the investors have sort of come and gone from some of these markets, the prices have held. So they may have accelerated the price appreciation. They may have driven prices up a little faster than they would have gone on their own. But once they've hit that new level, they've generally held. And that suggests that the value is still right for the properties that are being purchased.
I think that you're bringing up a real important point and really a concern of people that are investors. And I think maybe I don't know that the homeowners really thought it out because this is a new experience. I don't recall ever having this much money interested in single family homes. So to me, that's an unprecedented group of people. Mm-hmm. But what you're really saying is that collectively, all of these companies together have become market makers.
I think that's overstated in the press right now, Bruce, to be honest with you. I think on a localized basis, sometimes you could make an argument that they become market makers. Certainly, you look at Phoenix last year, you look at Atlanta, starting to happen in Las Vegas to a certain extent. But collectively, and you really have to think this through a little bit, there was $10 billion worth of funding announced last year, and you know that wasn't all spent. $10 billion as a percentage of the overall housing market where there were about 5 million units sold is really a rounding error.
It is. As a matter of fact, now you mentioned I've just been studying foreign buying and foreign buying something about $800 billion.
Mm-hmm. And so I don't think the institutional investors are really market makers in a broad sense, and I think it's been interesting press conversation that because it is a new phenomenon. We haven't seen this before. But in terms of actual impact on the overall market, I think that effect has been overstated.
You feel the same way then with rent values and that type of thing, that wouldn't be, they wouldn't have so much inventory that they would sway?
Not yet, because rental units are still occupied, you know, somewhere north of 95% across the country. Now, it may be what we have seen is, you know, at least on a short-term basis, you take a neighborhood in Phoenix, and suddenly there's a bunch of homes on the market for rent, and you might have a temporary oversupply because people can't break their lease on a day to move into something new. So there could be some softening of rental rates, but again, I don't think it's because all that inventory is hit at once.
Just to go backward for just a second, then I'll bring it forward to the houses. When somebody buys a note pool, FHA just announced that they were selling 40,000 notes this year. And that's in a competitive bid situation. Does FHA retain part ownership of that?
That's a really good question. I'm not aware of any of those type of arrangements where the seller retains partial ownership.
Okay.
I believe they're all outright sales. What I will say is that the government pools, the FHA pools, tend to come with more specific requirements and more specific language about what the buyer may or may not do with the pools. For example, I know in the FHA pool that was sold earlier this year, there was some language that restricted buyers from being able to foreclose on properties for a certain period of time.
Yeah, it was 6 months.
That required a certain percentage of loan modifications. So, mm-hmm. so there are more restrictions and requirements with the government pools than with the private pools. But I believe they're all outright sales.
And are these all auction type settings to where it's just the highest bidder gets it?
I'm sure highest bid is one of the factors. I believe there's also performance and disposition and considerations. and, you know, whether the bidder has a track record. So I'm not sure that it's necessarily 100% based on the highest bid, but I'm sure the bids have to at least be competitive.
Okay. Carrington has a model where they're going to buy and sell a property. Are there other models that you're aware of that are going to have the single-family homes kind of have a different disposition where they may be forming? And I'm actually saying things I'm not too sure of. I've never invested in a REIT, so when I say a REIT, I'm almost asking you to explain to me what it is. But I've heard that they're going to put these homes into almost like a scattered apartment-type REIT.
Yeah,
and then sell interest in that, and therefore they're not going to be coming back on the market.
Well, they will at some point. And that's probably one of the differences between a traditional apartment REIT, a real estate investment trust, in which people can buy shares, and what you'll see with some of the single-family homes. It would make sense to build a flexibility into a REIT like this where you can move certain properties out and replenish with other properties as they come to market. I'm not aware of anybody's plans that call for a permanent hold of the rental properties. The big variances tend to be the length of the potential hold and how much of the return for your investors you're planning to get from rental rates versus home price appreciation. I talked to a group in Indiana, and they were looking at 18% to 20% annual yields on their rentals, but they were really ultra-long hold. They didn't see home prices appreciating in a suburb of Indianapolis anytime soon.
Right.
We saw one big investor get out of Northern California because they were buying $300,000-$400,000 homes where you simply can't get rental yields because you can't charge, you know, $3,000-$4,000 a month rent for too many borrowers or for too many tenants. And what they saw was home prices appreciating more rapidly than they thought, so they got out and made their profit. So the REITs would be long holds. Basically, what you're counting on is the cash flow from the rental units basically being what you're investing in. Those building units would stay in the REIT longer than a typical, you know, buy and short-term hold. But there could be some transactions that move properties in and out of that REIT.
Okay. What would be a long-term hold? Give me a range, you think?
Probably anywhere from 5 to 10 years.
Okay, well, that's a long-term hold.
Yep.
Okay.
I think the average for most people going in was they were looking at probably a 3 to 5 year hold. If you're looking at a REIT, you're probably looking at something a little bit longer than that.
It would seem to me that most of the product that they will have in that REIT would have to be bought in the next 6 to 12 months to make sense.
Well, one of the largest investment groups looking at this is Blackstone, and they really believe there was about a two-year buying window, and we're in the second year of that right now.
Okay.
So as prices go up, it gets harder to get the returns that you're looking for.
Do they keep on switching locations, or do they do them all simultaneously?
You're actually seeing a movement right now away from some of the more, I'll call them, popular states. And typically everybody started where the foreclosure numbers were the highest. So you go for the states that the sand states, California, Arizona, Nevada, Florida. And what we're seeing now is a movement into sort of second-tier states, maybe states that didn't have as terrible a fall from peak to trough in terms of home prices, but where you can buy reasonably priced homes and get a reasonable rental yield on you know, for the next few years.
So it's really not a buy flip business so much as it just already cash flows and we'll just keep it. We've got about 40 seconds left. Do you think this model is going to be gone at some point, and they'll find something more traditional to do with their billions of dollars?
I think as there are other opportunities to deliver good returns, you'll probably see less interest in this. But I do think you're going to see a more permanent group of large investors in the single-family rental space when we come out of this cycle than what we started with.
Well, Rick Sharger, thank you so much for joining us, and we will speak to you in our next segment about the market.
Thanks, Bruce.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.